Shopping for skincare is frustrating. Buy it, try it, toss it, repeat. Curology is here to help. Curology pairs you with your own licensed dermatology provider who assesses your skin and prescribes you a custom formula to tackle acne, dark spots, or even fine lines. No guesswork, just a formula made to work for you. Get your consultation today at curology.com/Spotify. Curology, skincare with a face. Subject to consultation, subscription required, cancel anytime.
This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
The Vietnam War, it's over.
Your job's just begun.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of spycraft. Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer, streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
Welcome to the Olive Podcast. I'm Janine, Olive's deputy editor and podcast host, and each episode I'll be catching up with chefs, cookery writers, and characters from the food scene in Britain and beyond. Join us each week to expand your food knowledge as our guests share 10 things we need to know about the specialist subject. And do listen out for our effortless bonus episodes where they also reveal their top cooking cheats, hacks, and shortcuts. I'm delighted to welcome back Gerd Loyal to the podcast. Gerd is a food writer, future foods consultant, and regular columnist for Olive Magazine, sharing his favourite ingredients, books, producers, and foodie destinations each month. And this month, he's released his first book, finally, Mother Tongue, Flavours of a Second Generation, which is what we're here to talk about today. Welcome, Gerd.
Hello. We finally read it.
I think we've been talking about the book for the past four podcasts.
I think we have. That's quite meta, isn't it? Which means it's over a year.
And now it's here, and she's a beauty with a bright pink cover, which is just gorgeous.
It's pretty loud, isn't it?
I mean, how has it been since the book came out? Are you just... I was lucky enough to go to the launch party, which was...
It was a party. It was definitely not a show in return. Yeah. It's been amazing. It's been an incredible... Just seeing this thing that I've been creating kind of secretly in my tiny studio kitchen in Hackney and in the British Library, just on my own, just seeing it suddenly become a thing.
Yeah.
And it's like a physical object. I mean, when I first got the physical book in my hands myself, which was just for Christmas, it was... quite emotional, but now to have other people who've ordered it, some people ordered it 2 years ago, it's amazing. It's a really amazing feeling, and actually it kind of takes on a life of its own, because suddenly now people are reading it, they're reading their own things into it, they're cooking from it, they're adding their own stamps and twists to the recipes, which I just totally love. So it's really exciting. Ooh, I never really thought about the fact that at some point it kind of, it's like your child that you let go, and then you see it kind of take on whole new dimensions and whole new characters that you didn't even realise it kind of had. So it's really amazing.
But you said you started way back, you know, over a couple of years ago. What was the idea behind the book? Tell us a bit about that and how it came to be.
So, I mean, I've worked in food for probably 20 years now, and I spent a lot of my time, whether it was at Harrods or M&S in particular, I was often helping other people who'd bought out books to promote their books. And it was really interesting because a lot of people always said to me, well, you've done so much of this stuff now. Like, what do you cook at home? Like, you've got such a wealth of experience in food. And it kind of got me thinking. I was like, well, when I cook at home, I kind of do this sort of hybrid thing of things that are very British, very Indian, but that amalgamates all the stuff that I'm exposed to every day. And I was like, that's it's a little bit kind of, is that just something that I do myself? I'm not too sure. And then I sort of started talking about this idea of this sort of hybrid, amalgamated, kind of blended cuisine with other people, particularly friends of mine who are either British Chinese or British Caribbean, or I've got friends who are British Thai. And they were saying, that's exactly what we do. That's what we do. And, you know, we want people to write about this. Like, this is so interesting. And we sort of started, we were kind of having these conversations sort of over our lockdown walks and things about this. And I was like, I'm going to maybe put this down. Because actually, if I think about the food that is the truest expression of me, it is food that is not half British and half Indian. It is fully British and Indian at the same time, just like I am. So that's kind of where the idea came from. And it was something that as I spoke to more and more people, they sort of said, yes, that really resonates with how I cook as well. So I felt like it was a universal story, not just to British Indians, but to people of diasporas and people who are second generation, third generation, even first generation.
Yeah. So we're calling it kind of third culture cooking?
I use the phrase third culture cooking. And
I love that phrase.
It's a really cool, you know, and I can't claim ownership to it. It's not my phrase at all. It's a phrase that's, I suppose, used quite a lot in Asian American cooking.
Okay.
But really what it's getting to is this whole idea of not being tied to one culture or another and actually not being made to pick between them. Actually, it sort of intentionally sets its own path down the middle. So this sort of third culture in the middle and says, well, I'm not one or the other, I'm both. And a lot of diasporic cooks really kind of identify with this thing. Being third culture is not just something that's sort of attributed to cooking. You have third culture music, you have third culture fashion, you have third culture art. So it's a really interesting phrase that just, to be honest, it really resonated with me. So I've kind of taken it.
And it kind of loosens things up a bit, doesn't it? It allows you to sort of celebrate your heritage, but at the same time, step forward into something that is becomes you.
Absolutely. And there's this whole idea of kind of preservation of a culture, but evolution of a culture at the same time. And for me, I find these questions really interesting because food is such a sort of, it's such an emotive expression of culture. But for me, I don't think that you can only preserve your culture by recreating the past every time exactly how it was. I think you can actually put your own stamp on things.
Yeah, definitely.
And keep things alive. And I'm not saying that, you know, the recipes of the past and my mum's family in India and et cetera are not incredible, because they are absolutely incredible. But if I think about my story, my story is actually that having migrated to Britain and then me being born here. So the truest expression of me and actually the evolution of that culinary tale is for me to put my stamp on things and kind of say, well, you know, I was really fortunate to be given the world I've been given in Britain. I love going to India and I go sort of as often as I can, but also I've had this sort of worldly career.
Yeah.
So I kind of owe it to my past grandparents to say thank you by saying, well, this is what I've done with the food of our heritage.
Yeah. And I think it's, you know, reading the book, as you said, you've brought in a lot of the influence from your travels, from your work, from, you know, from your whole career. So it's not just British Indian. It then goes beyond that. And the ways of thinking about food are different. I mean, you were going to take us through some ways to put that third culture spin on your cooking. And we're going to start with amplifying your pantry ingredients. Tell us a bit about that.
Yes, absolutely. So there's a big theme within the book, around thinking about flavors as if they're musical notes and flavor combinations.
Yeah, flavor chords.
Flavor chords,
is that right?
As I call them. Yeah. So, I mean, I'm not a trained chef, but I've worked in food for sort of over 20 years and been working with chefs, and I've eaten a lot. I've been a professional eater, effectively. And for me, what I want people to do is to sort of hone their intuition.
Yeah.
So this analogy that I use around kind of flavor chords and kind of a flavor piano, what I want people to do is to really realize that in your sort of standard supermarket and kind of online websites, there are only certain ingredients that ever make it to the shelves.
Yeah.
And actually, if you go to a diasporic store, so an Indian supermarket or a Chinese supermarket or a Ghanaian store or a Greek supermarket, you're actually going to be buying products that are culturally rooted to those communities.
Yeah.
Because there's a reason that a Greek supermarket will sell certain olive oil or certain feta. There's a reason that an Indian supermarket will sell a certain brand of spices and have a plethora of different spices. And it's because the people that shop there regularly are really culturally attached to those brands and those products. So for me, I'm not saying abandon supermarkets because I love supermarkets, but what I'm saying is you can amplify your pantry by adding to your staples that you buy every week with a couple of ingredients bought directly from diasporic stores. And there is a world of flavour notes, as I call them, in those stores. And actually just going in, talking to the shop
keepers. Talking to them. I think that's quite important, isn't it? Because you said, you know, it's all about appreciation, not appropriation, which is about, you know, appreciating where things come from, asking about them, asking about the journey, asking about the history, you know, and kind of going into it that way.
And even asking the diasporic shopkeepers, you know, I really like the taste of this. What's similar? Like, you know, if you really like the flavour of cumin, go into an Indian shop and say, I really like cumin. What tastes similar to cumin? Or actually, what else do you think I'll like? Because actually, those shopkeepers will have a wealth of knowledge because they are serving Indian people in the most part. But by supporting the communities, as you know, appropriation and appreciation is ultimately about whether you're dominating a community or you're supporting them. The best way to support a community is to go and shop in their stores. I mean, there's no better way. But actually, you'll be learning firsthand. So that's, I suppose, my first one is, you know, support the migrating communities in your area. And every, you know, we live in a sort of multi-ethnic world now. There are loads of, particularly in London, but, you know, they're everywhere you are in the country. There will be a diasporic community that is sort of really will have a thriving food culture. Get involved, because they want you to be involved, and they'll be very, very inviting.
And also, when you get a hold of ingredients, you said that you should try and taste ingredients in isolation, like new ingredients. Try to kind of you know, expand your palate.
Yeah, that's my second sort of tip, I suppose, is to, I guess, almost train your palate with lots of different flavors, because the more you taste, the more you'll be able to sort of draw on, I suppose, sort of taste memories. What you're effectively doing is trying to sort of build the bank of flavors that you have in your sort of head and in your memory. Because then what you'll find is that when you're in the kitchen and you're trying to sort of bring things together and be a bit improvisatory and kind of, you know, be a bit playful, the more things that you've got in your sort of culinary head, of sort of the piano in your head, effectively, the more things that you can effectively play. So I really want people to sort of not only shop in diasporic stores, but then to just actually taste those ingredients in isolation on their own, but also learn how the way that one ingredient is treated can completely transform how it tastes. So you know, something as simple as an onion, you know, you can chop it in raw in big chunks and you get like a bit of a pungent bite, but you can really slowly cook that down with some butter and some onions and turn it into this sort of onion caramel almost. But even, you know, something like green cardamom pods, if you put them in sort of whole, they're going to be quite sort of sharp, quite lemony. But if you sort of toast them and then you sort of powder them down, they're really floral and almost sort of, you know, they'll be sort of like roses and strawberries. So it's interesting, because taste things in isolation, yes, but then also sort of learn how different treatments on an ingredient can then change the whole character of the ingredient.
Shopping for skincare is frustrating. Buy it, try it, toss it, repeat. Curology is here to help. Curology pairs you with your own licensed dermatology provider who assesses your skin and prescribes you a custom formula to tackle acne, dark spots, or even fine lines. No guesswork, just a formula made to work for you. Get your consultation today at Curology.com/Spotify. Curology, skincare with a face. Subject to consultation. Subscription required. Cancel anytime.
This episode is brought to you by Rakuten. If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of the hunt. But are you getting the thrill of the best deals? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Samsung, Expedia, and Sephora. And even stack sales on top of cash back. It's easy to use, and you get your cash back through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
New year, new credit scores. Chime makes it easier to build credit using your own money and on-time payments with the secure Chime Credit Builder Visa Credit Card. Use it everywhere Visa credit cards are accepted. To apply, just open a Chime checking account with a qualifying direct deposit. There's no annual fee or credit check required when applying. Get started at chime.com/build. That's chime.com/build. The Chime Credit Builder Visa Credit Card is issued by Bancorp Bank N.A. or Stride Bank N.A. Members FDIC. Late payment may negatively impact your credit score. Results may vary.
And that kind of leads into your next thing, which is about the characteristics of an ingredient rather than the ingredient itself. So there's this great a few pages of graphics where you've got these things called flavor bubbles. Is that right?
Yeah. Yes.
So things like, you know, nutty and roasted, vegetal and root, fruity, floral and tropical. The one that I was looking at, which I thought was a great example, was the salty and umami. So, for example, you could have something like anchovy to stand in for salt, but then you could also have soy that stands in for salt, or Marmite, you know,
all
those kind of yes. umami yeah. flavors.
Yeah.
So if you're thinking about putting a dish together, it's like what's going to bring in the salty element? I love that idea.
Yeah. And also, what have I got in my pantry that I need to use up? Absolutely. So this whole idea, I guess it's sort of is a build-on of this whole thing of mixing flavors from different cultures together. And what I wanted to do was to kind of empower people to do this. So the flavor bubbles in the book are sort of my way of doing that. So as you say, it kind of groups flavors not by where they're from in the world, but by the flavor characteristics. So, you know, salty and umami, there are hundreds of ingredients from around the world that have a salty and umami profile. And as I say, this is not a book about the science of flavor, but it is about ways of training your intuition. And this is broadly how I think about flavors. But absolutely, I want you to think about what ingredients do I have in my pantry, or actually what could I go and discover that could bring, you know, it could be, for example, a sort of sour and sort of acidic element. One ingredient that I use in the book all the time is amchol, which we've talked about many times, which is dried mango powder. I mean, it's probably the ingredient I use the most in the book. But for me, what I use amchol for is to bring that kind of acidic halo that things like lemon or lime would normally bring. But, you know, you could use vinegars, or you could use some tamarind, or you could use all sorts of stuff. So what I want people to do is to think characteristics first, and to almost sort of not be worried about a country or a cuisine, because mixing ingredients from different cultures is basically third culture cooking, and is delicious and is wonderful. I mean, do it in a respectful way and do it in a curious way that's genuinely interested in the cultures that you're taking ingredients from.
Yeah.
But do have a play, and that's kind of what that whole flavor bubble thing is.
Yeah. You've also got this really nice graphic at the front that it shows that you can take a base thing, and you take the example of tomato, garlic and basil, which is very Italian, classic Italian flavors together. And then you start saying, what about if we added this? What about if we added, you know, something Middle Eastern? What about if we added like, I think it's togarashi salt? And describing which direction it would take that base sauce into. I love that as well.
Yeah.
It's great.
I suppose that's my next one though, really. It's about starting by thinking about those classic combinations and classic dishes. So every culture effectively has its own classic flavor chords or flavor triads, if you want to think about them as music. So tomato, basil, garlic, absolutely Italian. Coriander seed, fennel seed and chili, very Punjabi. Something like scotch bonnet, thyme and allspice, very sort of Caribbean. So you kind of have these established flavor triads. But for me, what's really interesting and exciting, particularly in something like a bolognese, you know, add a little bit of cumin, add a little bit of tamarind. And actually, for me, what I want people to do is to think about how adding an ingredient either contrasts or sort of brings in something new. And for me, the most exciting combinations tend to sort of do a little bit of both.
Yeah.
But for me, the other thing, what I really want you to do is to sort of think about how you can take very classic things and just add a third culture spin to them. So something like, you know, we've talked about a bolognese, something like a Victoria sponge.
Yeah.
It's just such a classic recipe that is prime for playing with in an intercultural way.
Well, it's a blank canvas, isn't it?
Totally. So the Victoria sponge that I have in the book is a raspberry rose and passion fruit Victoria sponge. But there's lots of cardamom and lemon and all sorts of stuff that's going through it. But the other one, which is the simplest thing to play with, is scrambled eggs.
Yeah.
I mean, scrap me, for personally, if ever I'm trying, if I've got a new ingredient, a savory ingredient that I don't quite know what it is or how it works, I will often just cook it into some scrambled eggs to see what it does.
Because again, that's quite a nice bland base flavour. Eggs do tend to go with everything.
They do. But the other thing that's interesting about the eggs is that the fat in the yolk of the egg draws out more of the flavour and carries the flavour through it. So you kind of get a true kind of expression of a flavour. And if it's something that you're not familiar with, just add it to some scrambled eggs just to kind of help embed it to your palate. So, yeah, but kind of remixing the classics is a big sort of thing for me. And as I say, I really want people to play with flavour.
Yeah, Saturday morning, playtime.
Play exactly. Really
I'm going to do that. You're going to tell us about contrasting extremes of taste as well.
Yeah. This is another thing in the book that's sort of quite a signature of my cooking. I like to take things. I mean, there are no quiet flavours in this book.
It's very loud.
Exactly. The food is as loud as, I guess. But one thing that I find really exciting is mixing extremes of sweet and sour and umami and seeing what happens. And often people sort of say, well, you know, you can't mix loud ingredients with loud ingredients. I actually disagree. I think that what happens is when you do mix loud ingredients with loud ingredients, it sort of becomes this kind of explosive flavor bomb. So, I mean, one of the examples of this in the book, I've got tamarind, miso, and date short ribs with Kashmiri chili.
Wow.
So the tamarind is an extreme of sour. The miso is an extreme of salty umami. Yeah. And the date syrup is about as sweet as you can get. So it kind of combines, and these short ribs cook down really, really slowly. And they just become this kind of extraordinary combination of all of these things. It's just something completely new. Another one that I have in there is I do some sort of crunchy sort of chicken lollipops, which are basically sort of chicken wings effectively. But they are with kokum, which is a sort of sour South Indian ingredient, and black treacle.
Wow.
And this combination of very, very sour kokum and very, very sweet kind of molasses black treacle is really, really delicious. So you don't have to go to the extremes. But for me, I guess I have quite a sort of almost a Thai sensibility about my cooking.
Yeah, that sort of sweet, sour, salty.
Sweet, sour, thing. Salty and kind of balancing things.
Getting it balanced.
Yes. Yeah. But for me, actually, what I find exciting is often when you think about balancing, you're thinking about getting things sort of, you know, nice and
harmonious.
Neat.
Oh, yes, whereas
I mean,
you're like,
whereas I'm like, no, throw loads of this and loads of this, because ultimately it's still going to balance out.
Yeah, because I think you were talking about in one of the recipes, is it Taiwanese chicken where you get the salt, you get a sprinkle. Okay, there's a lot of sprinkling. There's a lot of sprinkle. There's a lot of sort of texture sprinkle. There's a whole chapter where you're talking about crisps.
Crunch. I mean, crunch is a big, almost a character in this book.
Yeah.
I love Taiwanese fried chicken.
Yeah.
I just love it. Like, one of my favorite things to do, either before or after a night out, is to go and have Taiwanese fried chicken in Chinatown.
Yeah.
Where my favorite thing about it is that they have all those flavor dusts.
Yeah.
And they're all so different. You've got like spicy tomato with cheese and like a sort of mala chili pepper. And then you've kind of got like a miso powder and nori seaweed and then like something totally random like plum powder.
Yeah.
And I love it so much. And it really does come through in a lot of my cooking.
Yeah. Love that, flavour explosions. You're going to tell us about getting curious as well, asking your friends about the dishes of their family, you know, really just doing a deep dive into other people's.
No, totally. Yeah. I mean, this is the thing about third culture cooking. It is very much an expression of the cooks and of the migratory journey that their family will have taken and then the continuing story of what happened to that family when they arrived in whatever country they sort of arrived in, and then the journeys they might have taken after that. So for me, there are every single family, and I talk about it in the book, every single family that's ever migrated anywhere, which is basically every family in the world, will have an incredible culinary journey and tale that's kind of entwined within what they cook every day. Like, there'll be a reason that they cook things on a Sunday or for celebrations or for feasts or whatever it might be. And for me, that's just so exciting, especially in the multicultural Britain that we live in today. This sort of idea that there isn't just one third culture cooking. There is as many third culture cookings as there are combinations of people to kind of be in the world. Yeah. So I find that really interesting and really exciting. I love talking to other people about, you know, well, what do you do on Sundays? Yeah. And what do you eat at weddings? And it's Easter, what do you cook for that? And I find that really interesting and exciting. And actually often the most inspired I am from a food perspective is when I'm having those conversations with other people. And then I'm invited into their homes, or we kind of do a Tupperware swap and we're swapping dishes and things. A friend of mine, Jenny, does an Asian dessert exchange, which is just one of the most fun things I've ever kind of been involved with, where we sort of get sort of 20 to 30 different Asian food creators kind of in London. And what Jenny does is sort of creates these Asian food boxes where everyone brings in something from their own culture. And I just love that, because you get, it's often sort of an interesting brief. There might be an ingredient that everyone's going to be used, or there might be sort of, you know, a sort of theme around it. But it's so interesting to have 20 diaspora Asian chefs of across Asia sort of just given this brief of, okay, everyone make a thing. And we then sort of turn these potlucks into kind of these boxes that Jenny sends out. I mean, she's Celestial Peach on Instagram. You must follow her. For me, you know, that for me has been one of the most inspiring things I've been involved with, because it is this sort of story of diaspora told through food. And there are hundreds of stories to kind of discover. And you just, you know, even in your own family, there'll be stories that you don't necessarily
know. Yeah, you said in the book that you know, in your own home, there was kind of this constant, like, exchange of Tupperware between. Because, you know, I guess the point you were making was your family's Punjabi. Yeah. But then that you had friends and relations, like from all over India. Absolutely. And everyone would do things differently. Yeah. And the really funny bit, I thought, was that you said if someone had brought Punjabi food, then it was game for being ripped apart by your mum and dad. Oh no, we wouldn't do it like that. But if it was from another region, you'd be fascinated by it. You'd be like, how did they make that chutney? How did they do this? We have to try and do it. I love that though.
I mean, it goes on to this day. Yeah. I mean, I was at home on the weekend and there was a hole in a Tupperware containers that contained amazing food. I was like, where's this from? It's like, oh, the neighbours across the road had a birthday the other day and they brought it over. So, I mean, I'm from Leicester, which is one of the most culturally diverse cities in the UK. I'm very, very proudly from there. So, you know, interestingly, although we grew up going to India every year, but we went to Punjab, which is where my family is. Interestingly for me, I ate across the Indian subcontinent in Leicester because, you know, we had friends or people that went to school with my dad, or kind of people that sort of both parents worked with, or neighbours who were from like Sri Lanka or from Tamil Nadu in the south of India, or from Bangladesh, or from kind of the Bengali area, or from Calcutta, or from Bombay. So completely different parts of India to where my family's from, or from Goa, or from Kerala, wherever it might be. So what was really amazing was that sort of between these disparate families, there was this constant exchange of food, because it was always, you know, Indians of all types, south to north, celebrate everything. So there was this constant stream of, you know, whether it's a religious celebration or a cultural celebration or a birthday or a wedding, whatever it was. So there was just boxes and boxes and boxes of food just circulating between houses always. And I was like, as you say, if it was Punjabi food that came back, we'd be like, well, it's not as good as ours. But if it was Keralan food or Goan food or kind of, you know, Bangladeshi food, it was like, wow, what is this? It's so, it was almost like it's a brand new cuisine. So it was fun. And it's, you know, it's the way that I love to live now. I love having this exchange of Tupperware containers between friends of mine in East London now.
Fantastic. I think I want to be adopted by your family, though. It sounds like such a riot. You said that salt and acid are like the brightness and contrast filters for cooking.
Yes.
I mean, is that how you use them? To turn it up, turn it down?
I mean, turn it up, turn it down. I mean, if you've ever been on my Instagram, you'll know I love a filter. So, yeah. I mean, when it comes to food, you know, I mean, this is not sort of a new idea. And, you know, that brilliant book, Salt and Acid Heat, sort of is kind of the tome that really kind of got this idea kind of out into the mainstream more. But salt and acid in particular, you know, if you're mixing ingredients from different cultures and you're not too sure about it, and when you kind of taste it, you're not too sure, a lot of the time, the thing that it will need is salt and acid. And actually, one of the things we talked about it a bit earlier, you can use lots of different things to bring in salt from different cultures. And you can use lots of different things to bring in acid. Or you can just actually add a tablespoon of salt and add a bit of lemon juice, or add a little bit of vinegar. And that for me is, I think, the thing when you're mixing ingredients from different cultures, don't forget about the salt and acid because they are still going to be needed.
Still going to need them.
And often they will help kind of amplify the flavors even more. But, you know, do think about, you know, what else could I use?
Yeah, cool. Let's talk about some exciting third culture food creators because I know you've got a few for us to go and check out online.
Third culture cooking is not something that's unique to me or to Britain. It's something that's, you know, sort of a global thing. One author that I really love is Eric Kim, who is a New York Times food writer who wrote a really brilliant book called Korean American. That's sort of, I guess, sort of doing what I'm doing from a third culture British Indian perspective, but from a Korean American perspective. It's a really, really incredible book with some really interesting flavor combinations. He's very sort of lyrical and about the way that he talks about this, and he weaves his own family story into it. And I just really like his writing, love his recipes. There's a brilliant writer called Sarah Woods who's just put out a book called Desi Kitchen, which is basically celebrating the sort of hybrid and blended cuisines of the South Asian diaspora across the country. So she's sort of been all the way from sort of Glasgow down to the tip of the country and spoken to people from South Asian communities. And she's sort of celebrating the whole country and different South Asian communities across the country in this book, which I just totally loved. There is a brilliant brand called Om Som, which is a sort of third culture Asian cooking sauce company. You can get them over here if you in a kind of a few select online stores.
Okay.
But it's a really interesting brand, and they talk a lot about sort of, they have a lot of very comedic third culture sort of Instagram posts and things that they do, which I think are really fun.
Cool.
And then the last one is a book that we talked about quite a bit, which is Chinese-ish, which I loved, which was by Joanna Hu and Rasheen Kaur. And that was really celebrating, you know, the ish there is the sort of third culture twist to their own Chinese sort of heritage. Really love that book.
As always, you're bigging up everybody else as well.
I know. You know.
But I mean, you are. You're such a great champion as well, which is brilliant to see.
I just think, you know, food gets more exciting when everyone picks everyone up.
Because
no ideas are ever sort of created in isolation. And actually, for me, what I want this book to do is, well, yes, it is my book telling my story. Actually, I'm really sort of open about the fact that this book, I want to open up the fact that there are thousands of stories, millions of stories that are as exciting and as interesting as mine, that are British Indian stories, that are third culture stories. And this is mine. But actually, I almost sort of wanting to use this book to kind of open the door and say, let's hear loads more because there are so many exciting stories out there.
And it is amazing storytelling. There's so much in there. A lot of brilliant and colourful intros, which are stories in themselves. And I've written down references to The Spice Girls, Fanny Craddock, Pucker Pies, Daytime Clubbing, The Karma Sutra, Mary Poppins, as well as loads of personal fun.
Pretty much every gay pop star icon that there is. Liberace's in there quite a lot.
Liberace's in there, Freddie Mercury, George Michael.
George Michael. But then, you know, Marla, the composer, Jacqueline Dupre, the cellist, is in there.
Of course,
Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan, the classic Indian singer,
And loads of personal family stories as well. Your mum and dad feature quite heavily.
They do feature. My mum in particular,
I know. Your mum was, she had a radio show. Who knew? It's just fantastic.
She did. And, you know, so my mum's radio show was a gossip and cookery show, basically. But what was amazing was that she would have listeners calling in, sharing their recipe wisdom.
Yeah.
And every single caller that called in would say, mine is the definitive recipe
for
this. Mine is the definitive recipe. And my mum would be so curious that every single recipe that was shared on air, she would make. So we grew up, you know, the one thing that I talk about in the book is this chickpea lentil cake called dokla, which is a very Gujarati snack. We would eat at least two or three a week because mum would say, oh, well, a listener's called in and actually they use half a teaspoon of baking soda and a teaspoon of baking powder, or, oh, they use lentil flour and they use chickpea flour, or, oh, they're fermenting their batter. And I mean, I feel like this dish is almost sort of as, it feels like it's something that I've always grown up eating because my mum just loved to experiment with all of that. But I love that. I love the fact that each of those iterations of that recipe was
a one family recipe had.
Every family had its own iteration of it. You know, I talk a lot about this idea of authenticity and what it kind of means. And for me, that's a great example because which of those is the authentic Dorkbar? No. They all are. They all are to their own families.
I mean, you only have to post an Italian dish on Instagram to see to talk about authenticity.
Exactly.
Because even all the Italians will start fighting with each other about whether it's right or not.
Exactly.
The ones I want that I've noted that I want to make. I mean, I said to you, I actually started writing down the entire book. But the ones that jumped out at me were the miso masala fried chicken sandwich, which is in the current issue of Olive magazine.
It is, yes.
Lovely book. Stilton and Tamarind Mumbai Toasty. God, that looks so good. The tahini malai wings.
Yes.
And the Kasundi Keema lasagna rolls.
Yes.
Oh, God, looks so good. But yeah, I just wanted to finish by what you said for number 10, which was stay curious, ask questions and play with your food. Because that's what the book's all about, isn't it?
It is. And, you know, this is sort of my whole ethos is I want people to bring their travels into their kitchen, to bring the people that they meet into their kitchen, to invite people into their kitchen, to angle an invite to be invited into someone else's kitchen and to play with food. And actually, for me, the food that is kind of the best expression of Britain today is food that amalgamates cultures together because we are this cultural kind of mix of all different things. And I think food is in many ways kind of a really connecting force. And I'm sort of, you know, really sort of powerfully stand for that. And playing with your food is just a delicious way of bringing people together.
Yeah, I love it. So if people want to buy the book, it's called Mother Tongue, Flavours of a Second Generation by Gerdie Bloyle. And you can find Gerd on Instagram at Gerd_Lyle. Is that right?
That's
brilliant.
Right.
Thank you so much for coming to chat to us today, Gerd.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Olive Podcast. For recipes and more information, head to olivemagazine.com. Do remember to listen out for our effortless bonus episodes where our guests reveal their best cooking cheats, hacks and shortcuts. And don't forget to subscribe at iTunes, Acast, Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.